Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be here.
Today, we're really going to explore the Kurdish people. We'll be drawing on anthropological perspectives to get a better handle on their society, their culture, and, you know, those big questions around their existence as, well, one of the world's largest stateless nations.
It's a huge topic.
Yeah.
And we've got quite a range of sources.
Yeah.
Academic papers, cultural overviews.
Right. The idea is to unpack what really shapes Kurdish life. You know, looking at everything from their history and language diversity.
Social structures, even contemporary challenges. It's a lot to cover.
Absolutely. So let's start maybe with the foundations, the history and geography.
Good place to start. I mean, we're talking about an estimated 30, maybe 45 million people. That's huge.
Oh, wow.
And they're rooted in this mountainous region, historically known as Kurdistan, but now split across Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria.
And that split, after World War I, that seems absolutely critical. It was done without their consent, right?
Exactly. The Treaty of Lausanne in 1923, that decision basically set the stage for a century of statelessness.
And that impacts everything, presumably.
Right.
Not just politics, but identity itself.
Deeply. It shapes collective identity, political movements, everything.
Okay, so going back further, the sources mention a really ancient presence, possibly linked to the Medes. And Xenophon writing about the Carducci. That's going way back.
It is. We're talking thousands of years. And the name Kurd itself might have evolved from a Middle Persian term, maybe for nomads.
Interesting.
It suggests a connection to a specific way of life that over time, especially after the Islamic conquests, kind of solidified into an ethnic identity.
And Kurdistan, it's more than just lines on a map then. It's a homeland concept.
Very much so. A cultural and conceptual homeland anchored by those really rugged Taurus and Zagros mountains. The sources call it a natural anchor.
Right, providing refuge.
Refuge, yes. But it also perhaps contributed to a certain amount of fragmentation. It fostered distinct traditions, protected people.
But maybe made it harder to unify against big empires, like the Ottomans or Persians.
Precisely. That's a key tension. The landscape that sheltered also, in a way, divided.
But it wasn't always about being subjects of empires. You mentioned sources pointing to real Kurdish political power at times.
Oh, definitely. Think of the Marwanid dynasty or the Ayyubids.
Saladin. I saw that mentioned. Saladin was of Kurdish origin. You don't always hear that emphasized.
It's true. It highlights that the history isn't just about being ruled, but also about periods of self-governance, autonomous emirates holding sway for centuries. That legacy is important for understanding today's aspirations.
Okay, so you have this long history, periods of agency, then this critical turning point after WWI Luzon.
Yes, 1923, dividing the land, ignoring Kurdish wishes. It's foundational to the modern Kurdish story.
The denial of a state at that point, it casts a long shadow.
A very long shadow.
Okay, so building on that historical and geographical base, let's talk language, another core part of identity.
Absolutely fundamental. It's an Indo-European language, Northwestern Iranian branch, so related to Persian.
But it's not just one language, is it? The sources call it a macro language.
That's right. You've got major dialect groups.
Yeah.
Kurmanji, which is Northern Kurdish.
Okay.
Sorani, or Central Kurdish. Then Southern Kurdish, which includes Kurmanshahi, Laki, Faili, and Gorani-Zazaki. So quite a bit of variation.
And can speakers understand each other easily across these groups, say Kurmanji and Sorani?
It varies. Sometimes there are challenges to mutual intelligibility. It's a spectrum. Diversity is, well, it's a cultural richness, obviously.
Sure.
But it can also pose challenges for, say, pan-Kurdish nationalist movements aiming for unity.
Makes sense. Are there efforts to standardize? I saw a mention of the Hawar alphabet.
Yes. Efforts like developing Latin-based alphabets like Hawar were attempts to create a shared literary platform to bridge some of those dialectal divides.
And considering the history, the repression of the language in places like Turkey, Iran, Syria, bans, couldn't use Kurdish names, no schooling.
It's dark. Keeping the language alive under that kind of pressure requires incredible resilience.
It really drives home how deeply language and identity are intertwined.
Absolutely. And the work of Kurdish intellectuals like the Bedirkhan brothers with their Hawar publication becomes even more significant. They weren't just publishing. They were actively cultivating a modern literary tradition against all odds.
Using the language itself became resistance.
A powerful form of it. And those revitalization efforts are ongoing, especially in the diaspora and places like Iraqi Kurdistan where there's more space for it.
The language is clearly a cornerstone.
Undeniably.
Okay, so let's shift gears a bit. How did people traditionally live? What were their livelihoods? Sounds like a mix.
It was very much adapted to the environment. A blend of pastoralism, raising animals, and agriculture.
Nomadic pastoralism in the mountains, moving herds with the seasons.
Exactly. Nomadic or semi-nomadic, mostly sheep and goats. This seasonal movement, called transhumance between summer pastures, Zoma or Yalak, and winter pastures, Germian or Kuschlak, required deep ecological knowledge.
And coordination, I imagine.
Yes, often coordinated at the clan or tribal level. You had the mobile tents for travel, and heavier, often black wool tents for the winter camps.
Right.
And the products, wool, meat, dairy, were vital for their own use and for trade.
And alongside that, farming in the plains.
In the fertile plains and valleys, yes. Settled agriculture, growing staples like wheat, barley, lentils. Also cash crops. Tobacco is a significant one. Livestock were often integrated into farming life, too.
But things have changed a lot. That nomadic lifestyle, it's declined.
Dramatically, especially in the 20th and 21st centuries. State policies, new borders cutting across migration routes, conflict, modernization, they've all played a part.
And the impact of that, sedentarization settling down.
It's had huge consequences on livelihoods, definitely, but also on social structures, land ownership, and cultural identity itself. Though some sources mention forms of enclosed nomadism still persisting.
A massive transformation, though.
A fundamental one.
So the things people made, their homes, that reflects this life, too.
Absolutely. Material culture is deeply manifold. You had the tents for nomads, but in villages, houses of clay or stone, often with flat roofs. In hilly areas, villages might be terraced up the slopes.
And village life itself, how was it organized?
Often based on lineage groups, sharing communal pasture land. Sometimes there were even rules against selling land to outsiders to keep the community intact.
And crafts. You hear a lot about Kurdish carpets.
Yes. Carpet weaving is incredibly important, known for vibrant colors, intricate symbolic patterns. Some say the patterns convey the weaver's hopes and stories.
Wow.
And other crafts, too. Spinning wool, weaving other textiles, making pottery, rope making. Very resourceful.
What about daily life within the household? Traditional roles?
Generally, there was a pretty clear gendered division of labor. Women often handled milking, making dairy products, food preparation, childcare, fetching fuel and water, and also helped significantly with harvesting.
And men?
Men typically focused on things like plowing, sowing, the main harvest work, trade, and more public affairs. This division reflected and reinforced certain power dynamics.
Patriarchal structure?
Largely, yes. But it's important not to oversimplify. These roles are changing rapidly with modernization, education, migration, new political ideas.
And for Kurds who've left Kurdistan in the diaspora, everyday objects can take on special meaning. Material capsules, the sources call them.
Yes, exactly. For displaced people, a simple object from home can become a powerful link to their past, to their identity. It helps bridge the distance, connecting past, present, and future.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosch, Hannah.
Bosch.
Oh, this smells amazing today. It's got that perfect hint of cardamom. You know, last time it was a little bitter, needed a touch more sugar, but today.
Yes.
Today it smells like she's really nailed it. The color's just right, too, that rich amber hue. Let's just take a moment, shall we? Properly enjoy this.
Ah, yes, the aroma is quite inviting today. A good cup of chai can certainly offer a moment of reflection. Good timing.
Yes. Perfect. Just the right balance of spices and sweetness. Definitely what we needed.
Agreed. Much better than last time.
Okay, right. Where were we? Yes, we were about to get into social organization. Kinship structures. The tribal system. This seems really fundamental, historically speaking.
It really is. For a long time, the tribe was the main framework for organizing society, politics, the economy, based on descent, kinship, real, or sometimes assumed connections.
Right.
These tribes usually have what anthropologists call a segmentary structure. Think of it like nested boxes. You have the main tribe, then sub-tribes, clans, lineages.
Like tier, haws, okaks, those terms.
Exactly, those kinds of terms. Varying by region. It goes down to the individual household. All linked, theoretically, back to a common ancestor.
And it's mainly through the male line, patrilineal.
Predominantly, yes. Patrilineal descent is the cornerstone for lineage, inheritance, identity. But it wasn't always totally rigid. Sometimes outsiders could be incorporated maybe as clients or through alliances.
And this system was especially vital for the nomadic pastoralists we were talking about?
Absolutely crucial for them. Coordinating migrations, managing shared pastures, organizing defense. The tribal structure provided the framework for all that.
Less obvious for settled farmers, maybe, but still there.
Still relevant, yes. Especially when conflicts arose, those tribal loyalties would often come to the fore again.
And the leaders within this system, the agas and sheikhs.
Two key types of traditional authority. Agas were generally secular chieftains. Their power often came from land ownership, wealth. They'd maintain order, mediate disputes.
Hosting people in the Diwan.
Yes, that hospitality and meeting space was important. They also represented the tribe to outsiders. Sheikhs, on the other hand, were religious leaders, often linked to Sufi orders, like the Naqshbandi or Qadiriyya.
Their authority was more spiritual.
Spiritual, yes, but they often mediated in worldly matters, too, using their religious influence.
So these leaders held significant power, but presumably central governments weren't always happy about that.
Often not. States frequently tried to either co-opt these leaders, bring them into the state system, or undermine their authority altogether to consolidate central control.
And there's an argument, isn't there, that this tribal structure itself, being so segmented, maybe made it harder for Kurds to form a unified state.
Yes, some scholars, like Hussein Tahiri, argue that the potential for rivalry between tribes could be exploited by external powers, divide and rule.
Makes sense. But then other sources stress how these same tribal structures provided the backbone for early Kurdish nationalist movements.
Exactly. It's a complex picture. While tribal divisions could be a weakness, the existing networks and loyalties were also resources that nationalist leaders, like Mullah Mustafa Barzani, for example, could mobilize.
So it's not a simple good or bad thing for nationalism. It's complicated.
Very. It's about the interplay between those traditional loyalties and newer, broader nationalist ideas. And, as Martin Van Bruinessen points out, the relationship with the state is always a key factor.
And these affiliations, they haven't just vanished in modern times. They still play a role.
They definitely persist and adapt. You can see their influence within modern political parties, sometimes contributing to factionalism, shaping local power dynamics, even underpinning alternative justice systems outside the state. It's a dynamic social form.
Okay, so let's zoom in on kinship and family, still strongly shaped by that patrilineal system.
Yes. Traditionally, lineage, inheritance, social identity all flowed primarily through the male line. Kinship terms often reflect this structure.
And marriage, often arranged.
Historically, yes, negotiated between families. And there was often a preference for marrying within the lineage endogamy.
Especially marrying a cousin, the father's brother's daughter. Why was that preferred?
The idea was often about keeping the family together, consolidating property, reinforcing solidarity within the lineage.
But could that also limit wider connections?
That's the potential downside, anthropologists note. It might limit broader alliances and perhaps even increase friction between different lineages.
And bride wealth, kelin, or share, that's a formal part of it.
Yes, a customary payment from the groom's family to the bride's, part of the formal negotiations.
Polygyny, having multiple wives.
Permitted under Islamic tradition up to 4 wives, but generally not widespread. Often the economic burden made it impractical for most. And divorce, traditionally, was often easier for men to initiate.
And the typical household, an extended family living together.
Traditionally, yes. A patrilical extended family, the couple lives with or near the husband's parents, with the senior male figure holding authority.
But like the tribal system, this is all in flux now, right? Globalization, conflicts, cities, education.
Absolutely. Contemporary kinship is dynamic. Especially in places like Iraqi Kurdistan after 2003, you see significant shifts.
Affecting family values, women's roles.
Definitely. And global media, technology. They're playing a role too, perhaps weakening some traditional collective values in favor of more individualistic ones.
Let's talk about handling conflict traditionally. It sounds like there were systems operating alongside, or sometimes instead of, state courts. Legal pluralism.
That's the term, yes. Legal pluralism. Multiple legal or normative orders existing side by side. Respected figures, especially agas, were central to mediation.
What gave them the clout to settle disputes?
It was a combination of things. Their inherited position, maybe wealth, but also their reputation for wisdom, fairness, the respect they commanded. They'd handle everything from family squabbles to blood feuds.
And the process itself, more about talking things through.
Very much so, often held in the aga's house or the Diwan. Disputants present their case, maybe witnesses speak. The aga facilitates, explores options, sometimes involving other elders. The goal is often restoring harmony, repairing relationships.
Which is quite different from formal courts, which can be more adversarial.
Exactly. And these traditional systems often persist because people might perceive state institutions as, well, biased, corrupt, inaccessible or just ineffective for their needs.
I read that sometimes even government bodies in Iraqi Kurdistan might ask agas to step in on tricky cases.
It happens. It shows the enduring social legitimacy these figures can hold. And it's not just agas. We also see new forms emerging within political movements.
Like the HDP's public relations committees in Turkey.
Yes, those PRCs became spaces where Kurds, and sometimes other groups who distrusted the state system, sought resolution.
And women were major users of these committees.
That's a key finding. It suggests they perhaps found these committees more accessible or culturally attuned to their needs than state courts. This whole area of informal justice is getting more scholarly attention now.
Fascinating. Okay, let's move on to religion. You mentioned earlier it's incredibly diverse.
It really is. A result of centuries of cultural exchange, local developments, interactions with major religions. The majority are Sunni Muslims, mostly following the Shafi school.
But also Hanafi and Sufi orders.
Yes, Hanafi Sunnis too. And influential Sufi orders like the Naqshbandi and Qadiriyya are very present. But beyond that, you have significant communities practicing Yazidism, Alevism, and Yarsinism, also known as Ali Haq or Kakai.
And these often blend different traditions, that syncretism you mentioned.
Exactly. They often weave together elements from ancient Iranic or Mesopotamian beliefs, Zoroastrianism, Sufism, and Abrahamic faiths into unique systems. Plus, historically, there were Kurdish Christian and Jewish communities, too.
I saw a note about possible early Kurdish Christianity before Islam became dominant.
There are narratives suggesting that, yes, adding another layer. And Kurdish culture is often talked about in terms of religious tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the KRG's approach to Sules, for instance.
But it's not always simple tolerance, is it? There's also a history of persecution.
Definitely. We need nuance here. Groups like the Yazidis have faced horrific persecution over centuries and more recently. So it's a complex mix. Diversity, blending, tolerance, but also conflict and persecution.
A really compelling area for understanding identity in that region.
For sure. How religious identity is shaped and negotiated when politics are so charged.
Let's zoom in on Yazidism, described as very distinct, resilient.
It is a unique ethno-religious group, predominantly Kurdish-speaking. It's monotheistic, but non-Abrahamic, with roots in ancient regional traditions, plus some Abrahamic influences.
But they've been wrongly labeled devil worshippers.
Tragically, yes. A pejorative and completely false label that has fueled terrible discrimination and violence.
Their core belief, one God and seven holy beings or angels, with Tawusi Melek, the peacock angel, as primary.
That's central. And their practice of strict endogamy, only marrying within the faith, and the fact they don't seek converts, these have been key to maintaining their distinct identity.
And Lolish Temple in Iraq is their holiest site.
The most sacred site, yes. A major pilgrimage center. They also have specific practices like a three-day fast in December.
In a traditional caste system, sheikhs, peers, murids.
Yes, a hereditary structure. Sheikhs and peers are religious figures or elders. Murids are the laity. Generally, marriage is supposed to stay within these caste lines, too.
And Sheikh Adi ibn Musafir, a 12th century Sufi figure who became central. That shows the syncretism again.
A prime example. He's seen as having reformed or solidified the faith, later venerated as an incarnation of Tawusi Melek. But their history, it's marked by resilience but also profound suffering. Centuries of persecution, massacres.
Like under the Ottomans and then the ISIS genocide in Sinjar in 2014.
Exactly. It's a stark reminder of the dangers of religious misrepresentation and the vulnerability of minority faiths.
What about Alevism among Kurds, particularly in Turkey?
A significant minority tradition there. Kurdish Alevis are a distinct segment within the broader Alevi community. Their faith blends Shia Islam reference for Ali and the 12 Imams with Sufi mysticism and older Anatolian or Iranic beliefs.
And they're maybe more distinct from mainstream Islam than Turkish Alevis?
Some scholars, like Van Brunessen, suggest that, yes, there's a strong emphasis on inner esoteric understanding, on love, tolerance, social justice.
And the Sem ceremony, with music, poetry, dance.
The Ayin Echem is central. Music on the Saz or Balama, mystical poems, the Ish, the ritual dance, Sema. Sharing food, it's a core communal practice.
And similarities in myths with Yarsinism suggest shared roots.
Potentially, yes. The historical relationship with Sunni Kurds, though, has sometimes been tense, marked by mistrust, linked to events like the Sheikh Said uprising or the Dersim massacres.
And their association with leftist politics in Turkey and facing persecution.
Yes, particularly in the latter 20th century. Events like the pogroms in Malatya and Karaman Mirage in 78 were horrific.
Yeah.
Kurdish Alevis often face a double bind marginalization as Kurds and as Alevis.
Different from both Sunni Kurds and Turkish Alevis.
Exactly, which fosters its own distinct cultural expressions. And interestingly, research highlights how Kurdish Alevi women use these intersecting identities to claim space and challenge discrimination.
Finding agency in that complexity.
Precisely.
Okay, and the third group, Yarsinism, or Ali Hak Kakai.
Another distinct system, mainly in Iranian Kurdistan, Kurmanchar region, and parts of Iraqi Kurdistan, like Halabja, Kirkuk, adherents are generally identified as ethnic Kurds.
Also syncretic, drawing on Shia Islam, Sufism, older traditions.
Very much so, with common threads connecting it to Yazidism and Alevism as well. Core beliefs involve divine incarnations, a cyclical view of history, reincarnation, Dunaduni.
A complex cosmology, and the jam ritual again, but with specific requirements. Seven men, a Sayyid, a singer with the timbre lute.
Yes, the jam meeting is vital, with ritual sharing of food and water. There's also a social structure with hereditary priestly Sayyids from 12 main lineages, or Khandan and laity. A required relationship exists between a follower, Murid, and their hereditary guide, peer, or Sayyid.
And their holy texts are mainly in Gurani Kurdish.
Yes, primarily in the Gurani dialect, including Harami and Leki sub-dialects. The main text is the Kalami Saranjam. This linguistic connection is strong. Many Irsanis identify as Gurun culturally.
Like Alevism, it probably emerged from Sufis blending with local beliefs.
That's a likely origin, yes. It's another rich area for studying religious formation and how groups maintain boundaries.
So looking across all these, Yazidism, Alevism, Yarsinism, the theme of syncretism is huge.
Absolutely. Deeply rooted blending of diverse religious streams.
And this idea of Kurdish tolerance comes up.
It does. Often cited historically and seen in some modern policies like in the KRG.
But starkly contrasted with the reality of persecution these minority groups have faced.
A profound contradiction. Yazidis facing genocide, Alevis facing discrimination and violence. Even historical tensions between Sunni and Alevi Kurds, plus pressure from dominant state religions in the region.
There's even that regional prejudice noted in some sources, suggesting Kurds were only superficially Muslim.
Yes, that dismissive view existed. So you have this paradox, a region known for creating unique syncretic faiths and for coexistence, yet profoundly shaped by persecution and the political use of religious difference.
Understanding that tension seems absolutely key.
Critical for any real anthropological understanding.
Let's pivot now to political anthropology. Identity, the state, resistance. This must be a major focus.
Hugely important. Understanding Kurdish nationalism, the movement for self-determination across divided Kurdistan, it's central.
How did these movements develop?
It evolved from the late Ottoman period through that post-WWI division and into the major struggles of the 20th and 21st centuries. It's not one single thing, though.
Not monolithic.
Definitely not. It's multifaceted, shaped by internal Kurdish social structures, different ideologies, and constant interaction with often repressive states.
So early uprisings might have involved traditional leaders, agas and sheikhs, using their existing networks.
Often, yes. Then later, especially mid-20th century onwards, you see the rise of more secular ideologies, socialism, Marxism, and organized political parties and guerrilla movements, like the PKK, for instance.
And that complex relationship between older tribal loyalties and modern nationalism is always there.
Always interacting, sometimes reinforcing, sometimes conflicting. A key area for anthropology is how Kurdish identity itself is constructed and negotiated, especially being stateless, facing oppression, and also in the diaspora.
Benedict Anderson's idea of the imagined community seems relevant here, building a sense of shared identity without a state.
Very relevant. How do you maintain that shared belonging across borders, across dialects, across different political experiences?
Mm-hmm.
Studies in the diaspora really highlight this active process of identity maintenance. Language plays a huge role.
And cultural expression maybe flourishes more freely in the diaspora?
Often, yes. And scholars like Abbas Vali, looking at the Mahabad Republic in 1946 Iran, analyze Kurdish nationalism as a response to exclusionary nation building by the dominant state.
There's also mention of a decolonial turn in Kurdish studies recently. What's that about?
It's about critically examining how power structures, like colonialism, even after formal rule ends what's called a coloniality of power, has shaped Kurdish experiences.
So looking at historical erasure, suppression of language and culture.
Exactly. and how even academic study has sometimes been marginalized or shaped by the perspectives of the nation-states ruling over Kurdistan. It calls for amplifying grassroots Kurdish voices and challenging Eurocentric viewpoints.
Which ties into state policies, assimilation, cultural erasure. This seems like a constant theme.
A grimly consistent finding in anthropological research. Policies in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria often amounted to internal colonialism or systematic attempts to erase Kurdish identity.
Under different names, Turkification, Arabization, Persianization.
Yes, using coercive methods, language bans in public life, education, media, forbidding Kurdish names for people and places.
Suppressing culture, or maybe just allowing a folklorized version.
Often, yes. Stripping cultural expressions, music, literature, clothing of any political meaning, and state-sponsored street writing that denies a distinct Kurdish past or just absorbs it into the dominant narrative, like claiming Kurds were just mountain Turks.
And direct violence, too.
Tragically, yes.
Yeah.
Forced displacement, destroying villages, especially during counterinsurgency campaigns, and mass violence, like the chemical weapon attacks and genocide in Iraqi Kurdistan under the Ba'ath regime.
That coloniality of power framework you mentioned, it sees the suppression continuing even without formal colonial rule.
Yes, including what some call epistemic erasure, the silencing or dismissal of Kurdish knowledge systems, perspectives, history. This affects lived experience, but also how Kurdistan is studied academically.
Often marginalized within Middle Eastern studies.
Reflecting those nation-state perspectives. So the decolonial approach argues for a critical rethink, centering Kurdish voices, using appropriate methods. How Kurds are represented or misrepresented or simply erased in dominant national stories is a key issue.
Let's talk about sacrifice. It seems to have a really profound meaning in some Kurdish political movements.
It does, particularly in armed struggles like the PKK. The concepts of korbani or fedakari, death in battle, is often framed as a heroic sacrifice, the necessary price for liberation.
A powerful mobilizing idea.
Extremely powerful. The veneration of martyrs, shahid, and invoking their memory is used to inspire continued struggle.
And anthropology looks at the afterlife of sacrifice. What does that mean?
It means looking at the long-term impact of this focus on sacrifice on society and politics.
Mm-hmm.
How does it sustain movements? How does it change people ethically? What happens during political transitions when the armed struggle maybe slows down?
Does the meaning of sacrifice change then?
It can create moral complexities. Yeah. How do you translate the value placed on revolutionary sacrifice into the different demands of, say, democratic politics? Classical anthropology saw sacrifice as maybe creating social cohesion, a kind of contract.
Like Meadows or Hubert.
Exactly. But more recent thinkers like Derrida or Bataille look at the disruptive revolutionary aspects. Sacrifice creating something excessive beyond simple exchange, a radical break.
And how does time figure into this?
There's chronological time periods of emergency versus periods of maybe democratization. But there's also a kind of sacred time where the revolutionary sacrifice feels timeless. The afterlife of sacrifice unfolds and the tension between these, as the immediate sense of loss maybe fades, but the moral and social order shaped by it continues to evolve.
It's a deep way to understand the power and the moral weight in these long conflicts.
Definitely.
What about contemporary Kurdish political entities like the KRG in Iraq or Rojava in Syria? Are anthropologists studying these?
Oh, yes, absolutely. These emerged in the early 21st century as really significant, though contested, experiments in Kurdish self-governance. They're crucial sites for research.
What kind of research?
Looking at state building from the ground up, internal politics, the challenges of governance, the unique ideologies driving them, their complex relationships with central governments and international players.
So the KRG in Iraq established parties like the KDP and PUK running things.
Yes, gaining formal autonomy after 2003. They function like a quasi-state. Mm-hmm. Own security forces, Peshmerga, parliament, bureaucracy. Research looks at KRG foreign policy, internal issues like protests, the often strained economic relationship with Baghdad over oil and salaries.
And how citizens view it. I saw mention of a mock state.
Some studies find citizens perceive it that way, projecting statehood externally, but maybe lacking effective governance internally sometimes.
And Rojava, the autonomous administration of North and East Syria.
That emerged during the Syrian civil war post-2011. The dominant political force, the PYD and its allies, implemented Abdullah Öcalan's ideology of democratic confederalism,
which emphasizes
inclusivity, grassroots democracy, gender equality, ecology, pluralism. Importantly, it rejects secession, aiming instead for a decentralized Syria. They've set up their own administration, security forces like the SDF, YPG, YPJ courts.
But facing huge challenges.
Immense challenges. Military threats, especially from Turkey, demographic changes, managing oil resources.
Yeah.
It's incredibly complex.
And ethnographic research there, what does it reveal?
It often shows the tensions between the revolutionary ideals and the practicalities of governing. Translating the philosophy into administration, dealing with neoliberal pressures, the persistence of traditional power structures like tribes, how ordinary people experience the new authorities.
And anthropologists also study Kurdish political parties working within existing states, like the HDP in Turkey, facing repression.
Yes. These entities, KRG, Rojava, parties like HDP, are like living laboratories for studying post-conflict governance, minority self-rule, how political theories play out in practice, and the evolution of Kurdish political hopes.
Okay, let's shift to economic anthropology. Livelihoods, economic transformations. There seems to be a big contrast between traditional economies and current challenges.
There often is. A history of local production and trade versus contemporary realities of underdevelopment, dependency, and poverty in many Kurdish regions.
Traditional economies being that mix of pastoralism and farming we discussed.
Yes. Transhuman herding, settled agriculture, growing grains, tobacco, fruits. Historical records, like from the Ottoman era, actually show Kurdish provinces generating significant tax revenues back then. Land tenure systems were complex state land, religious endowments, private ownership.
So what went wrong? Why the underdevelopment now?
Integration into modern nation states, often combined with protracted conflict, has led to what some call de-development. Iranian Kurdistan, for example, consistently ranks high in national poverty indices due to lack of state investment.
And southeastern Turkey, mainly Kurdish, also lags behind economically.
Yes. Veli Yadurga argues compellingly that the economic underdevelopment of Turkish Kurdistan is linked to the loss of administrative autonomy after the Ottoman Empire fell and the Turkish Republic was formed.
How so?
Dismantling the traditional Kurdish emirates disrupted existing economic networks, and the centralized states often didn't replace that effectively. A political economy approach emphasizes these structural factors. Historical control, how they were integrated into capitalism, state resource extraction, or simply neglect.
Sometimes states might subsidize these regions, but maybe more for control than real development.
That's often the argument, yes. Using economic levers for political purposes.
Let's talk about labor migration. It sounds like a really important survival strategy.
Crucial. Both internal and international migration, driven by economic hardship, lack of opportunity, instability, conflict, dispossession.
Within Turkey, for instance.
Seasonal work. Huge amounts.
Yeah.
Maybe 1.5 million Kurdish workers moving annually from the southeast to western rural areas for seasonal jobs in agriculture, forestry.
And that's analyzed as part of a racialized class system.
Yes. Deweys Deweys's work looks at it that way, a reliance on low-wage Kurdish labor within a regionally divided system. The Kurdish family often becomes the main unit organizing this migration, with kinship networks providing vital support.
But the workers face tough conditions.
Author, exploitation, poor housing, discrimination. And then there's international migration to Western Europe, especially Germany, the Middle East, North America, both for economic reasons and as refugees fleeing conflict.
And that has profound effects back home and in the host country.
Absolutely. Reshapes family structures, gender roles, community life, identity. Remittances sent home are vital. But migration also causes social disruption.
So the political economy of it all, development under development, it's all tied to political status.
Inextricably, state-led development projects are often seen as insufficient, unfairly distributed, or even designed to reinforce dependency, not empower people. It connects to the broader securitization of Kurdish areas, security prioritized over well-being.
That idea of a symbiotic relationship between the unresolved Kurdish question and development.
Yes, Yadirga's concept. Political subjugation contributes to economic marginalization, and underdevelopment fuels political grievances. It's a vicious cycle. State policies like militarization have had devastating economic impacts. Village destruction, displacement in Turkey, for example.
And neoliberal policies, they create new issues.
New class divisions, inequalities, even within Kurdish governance structures and movements. Control over natural resources like oil and gas is obviously critical, but also highly contentious look at the KRG Baghdad disputes or the situation around oil in Rojava.
The struggle over resources is central.
Central to economic viability and political aspirations. Anthropology often critiques top-down development and pushes for local participation, fair resource distribution, and tackling the root political causes of marginalization.
Are there specific, maybe desperate livelihood strategies that emerge from this? I saw something about Kolbari.
Yes, the Kolbari in Iranian Kurdistan. It's a stark example. These are cross-border porters carrying incredibly heavy loads on their backs across dangerous mountain terrain between Iran and Iraq, sometimes Turkey.
Get very little money.
For meager wages, yes. Driven by sheer necessity due to extreme economic deprivation, lack of formal jobs, often linked to state neglect or repression. It involves men of all ages, even teenagers, sometimes women too. Many are educated but can't find work.
And it's seen as a political issue, not just economic hardship.
Ahmad Mohammadpour argues strongly it's political, a result of economic apartheid or internal colonialism. The state securitizes the border regions, de-develops Rojalat, Iranian Kurdistan, leaving few alternatives.
And the state treats them as criminals.
Yes. Labels them smugglers to delegitimize them. And border guards often shoot at them, causing deaths and injuries. Studying Kolbari ethnographically really shows the human cost of this intersection of economic marginalization and state violence against an ethnic minority.
A very tough reality. Let's turn to the diaspora now. Kurds living outside Kurdistan. It's a huge phenomenon.
Massive and multi-layered, driven by political persecution, conflict, economic pressures, seeking freedom. You have historical Kurdish communities outside the main region, central Anatolia, Khorasan in Iran, the Caucasus.
And the modern diaspora?
Largely in western Turkish cities like Istanbul, Western Europe. Germany has the largest community in North America, Australia. Yep. Different waves of migration at different times for different reasons.
Labor migrants in the mid-20th century, political refugees later.
Exactly. People fleeing repression in Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Syria at various points. Like the Iraqi Kurds resettled in places like Binghamton, New York from the early 90s. So the diaspora itself is very diverse.
Diverse in origin, generation, politics, experiences.
You have to account for that heterogeneity.
And anthropology studies how identity is maintained, negotiated in these new settings.
Yes, the diaspora is a crucial space for that. Often there's more freedom to express Kurdish identity than in parts of the homeland. How do people maintain connections while adapting? Language is key again.
Cultural expression flourishes more. Music, dance, activism.
Often, yes. There's also a selective remembering of history, focusing on key events, including chosen traumas, like the Anfal genocide.
How does that shape identity?
Memorializing these events fosters a sense of shared suffering and resilience, binding the community, informing political consciousness. And transnational political activism is huge, using the freedoms in host countries. Exactly. Lobbying, raising awareness, supporting movements back home, mobilizing for rights. This activism itself shapes diasporic identity and a sense of belonging across borders. Though, politically, the diaspora reflects the same diversity of parties and ideologies found in Kurdistan.
What about younger generations? Second-generation Kurds?
Their engagement often differs. They might connect with heritage in new ways, perhaps more attuned to the host country context, sometimes less formal, but maybe more public in their expressions. And material culture, those diasporic objects we mentioned, become important anchors.
And technology, media, how does that change things?
Profoundly. The internet, social media, they've transformed transnational connections. You hear terms like digital diaspora or mediated homelands.
Creating connections across vast distances.
Yes. Sharing narratives, mobilizing politically, maintaining a collective identity. The siege of Kobane in 2014 was a key moment.
How so?
Digital media really unified the diaspora around that event, fostered pride, especially among younger people, the Kobane generation.
Yeah.
Social media became vital for sharing info, organizing solidarity, creating a digital record.
The visibility of fighters like the YPJ women resonated online.
Strongly, yes. These platforms allowed discussions about history, culture, politics, embedding Kurdishness in digital life. Plus, just staying in touch with relatives, following news, participating in online groups. It creates a constant mediated sense of connection to the homeland.
Satellite TV, websites too.
All part of this transnational communicative space. Anthropologists are increasingly looking at how these digital practices shape belonging, identity, politics for diasporas in the 21st century.
Let's address gender now, roles, agency, how anthropology looks at Kurdish women's experiences. Traditionally, quite a sharp division of labor.
Generally, yes. Traditional Kurdish society often showed a clear gender division, and the patrilineal structure tended to position men with more formal authority. Women's roles focused on the domestic sphere, food, childcare, household management, but also crucial contributions to farming and pastoralism, like milking, dairy, harvesting.
Men doing the plowing, handling bigger animals, trade, public stuff.
Typically. This division reflected and reinforced patriarchal authority. Often lower literacy rates for women, less formal political involvement in traditional contexts.
But we shouldn't paint it as monolithic. Women weren't powerless.
Absolutely not. They were integral to the economy, held informal influence, and depending on class, region, tribal background, individual circumstances, they could have varying degrees of freedom and autonomy. Rural or pastoral life might offer different kinds of agency than urban settings.
And things are changing significantly.
Massively. Increased education for women, urbanization, migration, the impact of conflicts, exposure to global feminist ideas, and crucially, women's own participation in political and social movements are all transforming roles and status.
Like in Iraqi Kurdistan after 2003. New opportunities, new challenges.
Yeah, exactly. Navigating shifting norms. Anthropology is increasingly focused on these dynamics, on women actively shaping their lives.
So what about women's contributions beyond the traditional roles in politics, society, the economy?
They've shown remarkable agency and made substantial contributions, often pushing against traditional norms. Their participation in political movements is noteworthy, from civil activism to community organizing and even armed struggle.
The image of female fighters, the YPJ in Rojava, the PKK historically became very prominent internationally.
Yes, challenging both patriarchal norms within Kurdish society and extremist ideologies externally. Involvement in armed resistance for some provided leadership opportunities and shifted perceptions.
And in civil society,
women are often at the forefront advocating for human rights, gender equality, peace building, cultural preservation. We mentioned Kurdish Alevi women using their identity to claim space.
And the Woman, Life, Freedom, Jin, Jian, Azadi uprising in Iran in 2022. Kurdish women were central there.
Absolutely central. They've also been instrumental in using alternative justice systems, like being primary users of those HDP committees. They're active in peace efforts, shaping post-conflict discussions. It's multifaceted agency.
Making them crucial subjects for research on gender, power, social change. And feminist anthropological research specifically, what has it brought to the table?
It's made huge contributions. Scholars like Shirzad Mojab, her edited volume, Women of a Non-State Nation, back in 2001, was groundbreaking, really establishing Kurdish women as a vital subject.
What's the focus?
Emphasis on intersectionality is key. Understanding how gender interacts with class, ethnicity, religion, their status as part of a stateless nation, experiences of colonialism, conflict. It avoids essentializing Kurdish women and looks at the diversity and complex power relations.
And including Kurdish women as researchers themselves, decolonizing the research process.
That's increasingly important. Moving beyond just being subjects to being active knowledge producers. Though there are internal challenges within the field being discussed too, regarding equitable environments for women scholars.
I saw mention of genealogy, science of women. What is that?
It's a concept that emerged from within the Kurdish women's movement, particularly linked to Abdullah Öcalan's philosophy. It seeks to create a new paradigm of knowledge centered on women's experiences, history, and perspectives.
Seen as empowering, a form of feminist practice.
Yes, often viewed that way by proponents. Its theoretical underpinnings in relationship to broader global feminist theories are subjects of ongoing academic discussion and analysis. Feminist anthropology engages with these kinds of indigenous theorizing.
So the goal is nuanced, critical analysis that challenges patriarchy.
And advocates for decolonial feminist perspectives, yes.
Let's talk about oral traditions. Folklore sounds incredibly rich and important.
Exceptionally so. Orality has been central, the main way language, history, values, memories were transmitted for centuries, especially when written Kurdish faced suppression.
A predominantly oral culture for a long time.
For much of their history, which makes the oral arts vital for cultural survival. You have the Dengmi JS.
The traditional singers and storytellers.
Revered figures, masters of epic poems, known as Laj or Kilim, telling heroic tales, historical events, and also songs, stran, including laments. Their role during periods of language bans, like in Turkey, was indispensable.
Keeping the language and stories alive, sometimes secretly.
Exactly. It wasn't just entertainment. It was a living archive of culture and resistance.
And even foundational written works like Ahmed Khani's Memuzin from the 17th century. It drew on oral tales.
Yes, that epic romance, considered a cornerstone of Kurdish identity, has deep roots in oral narratives, and itself continued to be widely spread orally. The enduring power of these epics and the continued practice of Dengbeji really underscore the significance of orality.
And folklore, more broadly, proverbs, songs, myths, it's seen as reflecting cultural memory.
Yes, and it was actively mobilized by Kurdish intellectuals and artists, especially in the 20th and 21st centuries, as a source of authentic heritage and a tool for building national identity.
Part of cultural nationalism, seeing the folk as the pure spirit of the nation.
That was often the impulse. Early intellectuals, like the Bedirkin brothers again, saw the potential of collecting and publishing folklore in journals like Hawar and Runahi. They saw it as vital for literacy, cultural preservation against assimilation, and fostering national consciousness.
So collecting folklore was also a political act.
Deeply intertwined with political aspirations. A way of demonstrating historical depth, resisting erasure, building a sense of shared identity.
And does this folklore still influence modern Kurdish literature and arts?
Very much so. Writers like Mehmet Uzun or Mehmet Dikel, for example, consciously draw on folkloric themes, characters, narrative styles. It's not just nostalgia, it's a creative reinterpretation, connecting historical memory to contemporary concerns. It's seen as cultural and language revitalization.
A living connection.
A dynamic interplay. Tradition informing the new.
Is this connection well studied?
The influence is acknowledged, but detailed scholarly work tracing the specific links and transformations is still developing. Sometimes oral tradition is seen as both a strength, providing a unique voice, and a potential weakness if relied on too heavily without innovation. More research focuses on political or popular culture than, say, the contemporary context of traditional storytellers themselves.
But that dialogue between oral and written, traditional and modern, is clearly a key part of Kurdish cultural dynamism.
And of great anthropological interest.
Finally, let's touch on the study of Kurdish anthropology itself. Who are the key scholars? What are the main approaches?
It's a field shaped by dedicated researchers, often working under difficult conditions. Martin Van Brunessen is hugely influential. His fieldwork across Kurdistan since the 70s and his book Aga, Sheikh, and State are seminal works on tribal structures, leadership, state relations, nationalism. He's also written extensively on religion.
Others?
Early on, you had physical anthropologist Henry Field doing surveys in Iraq in the 1930s. More recently, Maria Teresa O'Shea's work on geography and identity, Janet Klein on Ottoman-Kurdish relations.
Abbas Avali on nationalism in Iran, Hamit Bozarslan on a trans-state nature of the Kurdish issue.
Yes, both pivotal.
Yeah.
And Shahrzad Mujab bringing feminist perspectives with that edited volume on Kurdish women. Early work by Ismail Bishikshi in Turkey on tribes as an internal colony, Leli Yelsin Hekman on kinship. More recent work includes Ezin Dusel on the afterlife of sacrifice, Denise Duriz on labor migration, Ahmad Mohammadpour on the Kolbari. It's a growing body of work.
And how has the approach changed over time?
It's evolved. From early descriptive ethnographies and physical surveys.
Measuring skulls and things.
Sometimes, yes. To more theoretically engaged analyses. Van Brunessen brought in structural and historical analysis of social and political organization. Contemporary studies draw on political economy, feminist theory, intersectionality, post-colonial, and decolonial theories.
Looking at state power, assimilation, knowledge production.
Exactly. And theories of sacrifice, memory, trauma. But ethnographic fieldwork, that deep, immersive engagement, remains fundamental despite the challenges. Researchers also use oral history, textual analysis, archival work. Methodological pluralism is key.
And more engagement with Kurdish scholars themselves.
Increasingly, yes, which is vital for enriching the field and moving towards that decolonial approach we discussed.
Where is this research published? Are there key journals?
Journals like Kurdish Studies, the International Journal of Kurdish Studies, Journal of Middle East Women's Studies, Current Anthropology, HAU, British Journal of Middle Eastern Studies, book series from publishers like Brill and IB Taurus Bloomsbury focus specifically on Kurdish studies. The Cambridge History of the Kurds is a major recent reference work.
And that decolonial turn is actively debated within these forums.
Yes. It's about critically reevaluating how power has shaped knowledge about Kurds, challenging state-centric views, amplifying Kurdish voices, using methodologies sensitive to local ways of knowing. It's an ongoing effort, facing challenges like limited funding and state hostility, but aiming for more ethical and empowering knowledge.
It sounds like a field grappling with its own history while trying to understand a very complex present.
That's a good way to put it.
Well, this exploration today, looking through these anthropological lenses, it really paints such an intricate picture of Kurdish life. We've covered so much ground.
From the ancient homeland, through the complexities of language, social structures, the incredibly diverse religious landscape.
To the impact of statelessness, political movements, economic shifts, the diaspora experience.
And the scholarly work trying to make sense of it all.
It's really just a glimpse based on the sources we had, into such a deeply layered history and a very dynamic present.
It highlights the immense challenges, certainly, but also the remarkable resilience and cultural richness of the Kurdish people.
Absolutely. It leaves you thinking about the profound impact of their ongoing quest for recognition, for self-determination. Hopefully this has sparked some curiosity for you, the listener, maybe opened up new avenues for your own thinking.
One thing that really stands out is how identity is constantly being negotiated in relation to the state, to tradition, to modernity, to the diaspora. Perhaps a question to leave listeners with is, in a world still largely defined by nation-states, what alternative forms of belonging and political community are being imagined and built by stateless peoples like the Kurds, and what can we learn from them?
A powerful thought to end on. Thank you for that. And thank you all for joining us on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.